Welcome to our Goldster podcast. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Goldster Inside Story. And thank you for coming along this Good Friday. I am thrilled to be here today with Paul Cronell and Sarah Lou Young, who've written this really funny book. If you can see it here, The RSV People. Very, very good. And I have been wallowing in nostalgia. So for anybody here who remembers the 80s and remembers smash hits, whether that's you, whether it was your children who used to read it, whether you don't know what I'm talking about, this is the book to buy for anybody who was an 80s kid, because this is just a brilliant, brilliant idea. So Paul, Sarah Lou, tell us, what is RSV People?
The RSV People was a book that came about entirely by accident. One Christmas, Sarah's brother sent a whole pile of Christmas presents, all wrapped individually, literally about 40 of them. You know, there was a little Mars bar and, you know, little stuff. And one of them was a copy of Smash Hits. And were we in lockdown then? We were locked down.
Yeah, it was Christmas Day and we decided to read it with glasses of champagne. So it was also a slightly drunk decision. In
I had one of those moments where every copy of Smash Hits had a pen pal section.
Yeah.
And the pen pal section back then had all these 12, 13, 14-year-olds and their full postal addresses. And just for a moment, had a sort of light bulb moment of going, gosh, I wonder where these people are now. I wonder what happened to them. And then because we had all their addresses, we literally sort of went, let's find out. So we just wrote to them as if we were 12, 13, 14-year-olds, not pretending to be 12.
Yeah, yeah. I'd just like to make that clear. There was no agreement.
No.
But we just wrote to them. We got colour-coordinated paper.
Oh, yeah.
Fine detail people. Yeah. We spent a long time.
Painfully retentive.
I think quite a few days crafting the first letter. Also,
yes.
I mean, it was just amazing because, of course, today with data protection, you just wouldn't put your full name in a publication. And for those who don't know what Smash Hits was, it was the pop mag of the day. And the thing that, did you get it as a kid?
Oh, I did. Yeah. I had stacks of them.
I did.
It had the lyrics to the songs in. And of course, this, you couldn't just listen to a song on iPlayer. You'd hang out on Sunday night to listen to the top 40, desperate to hear the song that you loved. So having the lyrics was a kind of way of owning the song and being able to enjoy it again. So it was a big part of our childhood.
Yeah. And I think the thing was, I'd always had the urge to do something like Dave Gorman, Danny Wallace, you know, start a project, an adventure to try and do something faintly ridiculous, but something that would turn into an enormous event. So we did that. So we sent out 24, was it 20, 24?
24 people, 24, 20, 20, yeah. 20 letters.
We sent out 20 letters saying, hello, we saw you put an advert in Smash Hits.
35 years ago.
We just wondered whether you'd still like to write.
And we enclosed addressed envelopes. Now, one of the challenges was most people only had their first names, a lot of people.
Yes.
Some people had pretend names that they had gathered from. We've obviously, in the book, we've changed everybody's names and we've changed the addresses. So Rhubarb and Custard was one of the names that we were given. We were like, where do we go with Rhubarb and Custard?
People were brilliant, though, because obviously most people... all of them, nobody lived at the house they lived in when they were small.
But
the reason we put stamped addressed envelopes in is so whoever lived there now might know where they were. So we got about half of them back.
I was wondering just quite how many you got back, because that seems quite a lot. On average is how much people move.
But some people, we had some wonderful stories. Like there was one lady, it was the Rhubarb and Custard girls, they were. The lady who received our letter remembered that there had been no. The lady who lived in the house now showed it to a neighbor who'd been there for a long time, and the neighbor said, "Oh, there was a girl who lived there with her mum and dad decades ago, who was the sort of girl who might have done that." And she did some of the detective work for us.
Oh, brilliant!
And then she got the letter to Rhubarb or Custard. I can't remember which one. And then she got in touch with us.
Yeah, we had a lot of wonderful we thought we'd get to know these pen pals. And actually along the journey, we made other RSV people. Like there was quite a lot of, the dream scenario was that everything was done with pen and paper. Now, of course, they reached a point where we could go no further with pen and paper. So we had to revise our terms and conditions, which was we wanted to get the real letter in their hands. But if we had to use the internet for some sleuth detective work, and Paul is, you could have been a detective in another life, I think. Yeah. There were definitely points on, there were points in the journey when you said, I think I need to step back. I feel like I know too much about these people. Yeah. You ended up posting on like old girls associations, because some of the addresses were schools and schools that didn't exist. Anymore. But we had an amazing, amazing help from people who just got really emotionally and personally invested.
Yeah.
And we've remained friends. We don't want to give too many spoilers, but.
I think you need to give some spoilers for those who haven't read it, because there's just some, I mean, there's one, I remember near the beginning, there's a sad, well, I found very sad, there was a, I think it was about 13-year-old boy who was at boarding school saying, I'd quite like to write to girls between 12 and 14, but if anyone who wants to write to me, and I thought, oh my God, this lonely little boy at boarding school. And you just think these kind of, this was a real lifeline for people, wasn't it? I mean, we're giggling about it, but actually for some people, this was really important.
Well, absolutely. And that we were absolutely blown away with how many responses these kids got. They got thousands of letters, thousands. The number of people who said, postmen were saying, it does somebody famous live at this house? There was one lad in, one of the guys in a boarding school, he got so many letters. You didn't get the letter, all the letters went to the office. And then I think a board, on the notice board, a list was put up of all the boys who'd got letters. And he said in the end, new pieces of paper had to be put up because he couldn't list how many there were. what was quite interesting about him is he reckoned he got something like about 3,000 responses.
Wow.
And they didn't reply to any of them. Because with 3,000 letters, they went, and of course they had no money.
Think of the stamps.
Yes, exactly. The cost of sending letters.
But the lovely thing we had from that, he replied to ours.
We were the only ones.
It may have been 35 years late, but he replied to one.
So tell us about the kind of responses when you finally reached the right person. What did they think? Were there people who were a bit scared by it? Were they freaked out? Did they love it?
It was a real mixture, wasn't it?
Well, on the whole, yes, I suppose a few people were a little bit sort of, what's this about? Because, you know, these days everyone thinks that there's nothing innocent going on. Everyone's always after something.
Yeah.
Some people just went, this is brilliant, yes. Some people wanted to become pen friends, you know, as in they just wanted to, let's just communicate backwards and forwards. Some people just sent a single letter saying, this is great.
We got some photos.
I saw that. Yeah. Tell us about some of these photos.
Oh, we got some great throwback photos to the 80s. Somebody sent a picture of them because they'd actually, when they put the ad in Smash Hits, they'd got some copies of photos of them, you know, with the proper old big gel in the hair and the leg pads, and they'd kept one of them. So they sent that to us, which was lovely. I think the thing that was amazing was how much personal information people shared with us. And we've made, this book is about the quest. It's about the quest. It's also about our relationship. So people, the nicest thing people have said, it's like a love letter between us, because in the middle of this, we're also moving house. We're dealing with bereavement. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that's going on. But so we haven't put copies of the letters in the books because that's not fair for those people. But it's also not really about what it is. But the personal information that people shared and the vulnerability. And I think there's something about the written word. It's so intimate.
Absolutely.
And putting actual pen to paper, which, you know, we had a guy walk through a snowstorm for 2 hours in Canada to pick up our letter, and he said, I've got it, I'm gonna wait and I'm gonna write it to you and send it by snail mail. And just the
that's people, so lovely,
so lovely.
So tell us about your most exciting discovery of the people. Was there someone who you really didn't think you could find and then you did, or was there a lovely story attached to any of them?
Well, there was one lady. She was half Japanese, half Swedish. And Smash Hits had got her name wrong. They'd got the town that she lived in wrong. They'd got her postcode wrong. and we still found her.
Because she lives in Sweden, doesn't she?
She lives in Sweden. But of course, a lot of the time, it wasn't Smash Hits' fault. It's just these 13-year-olds are all writing
in
hand. And the guys at Smash Hits were just going, you know, is that a G or an S? Just pop it down. So, I mean, that was nice. We found we managed to get in touch with some of the people who worked at Smash Hits back then.
Yeah.
And one of them knew Sarah.
Was at school with Sarah. Yeah.
You know, she'd gone there as sort of work experience or something.
I was going to say, I think that the one that was the most moving and the most surprising, there was somebody that we just couldn't find any information about them over the last 5 years on social media. And we sort of picked up that there was some family difficulties. And that's when we almost stepped back from it. We thought, oh, this is not, we don't want to interfere with anybody. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, this person was in prison. And they wrote to us and we never asked anything about why they were there. We didn't investigate. That wasn't what the conversation was about. But we had the most, and we still continued the correspondence, and they're now no longer in prison. And they sent us poems and we had quite a beautiful correspondence with them. And that was, and we found somebody who had married their Smash Hits pen pal. So
tell us about this one.
Well, didn't he had a list. He had the numbered answers.
Yeah, he was.
That was amazing.
He was almost a sort of OCD about his collecting of pen pals as we were about finding.
He'd
kept a league table of the various people who'd been in touch. Because what a lot of these pen, I mean, anyone over the age of 14, as well as looking for someone who was into Spandau Ballet and Wham, a lot of them were just starting to look for potential romance as well. You know, everyone, they were looking for boyfriends and girlfriends, even though that wasn't explicit in the adverts. But this chap, he'd chosen five girls, potential
suitors.
Yeah. And he gave us basically his romantic pursuit of all five of these. I mean, very innocently, but you know, he would tell us that this one was terribly good looking, but she wasn't as funny as maybe this other lady was. It sounds weird now. I mean, the ladies now, but obviously there were girls then.
Yeah.
These girls. In the end, he ended up marrying sort of number three, but always regretted that number one, you know, I think he'd met quite a lot of these girls.
I was wondering, so people got to meet up. I mean, in this pre-internet dating age, it was, you know, checking who lives closest to you and getting to meet.
Well, there was one, I mean, although we found one of the people who themselves was in prison, one of the ladies we got in touch with, when her mum and dad, she got so many responses from young lads in prison,
You know,
because they're bored out of their minds and what have you. And she says she remembers on the day that the sack loads started arriving at the house, her mum just said, "You're not writing to anyone in prison." Just not allowed to. So
it's so fascinating, isn't it? The idea of these people putting something in Smash Hits and literally getting sack loads of posts. As you said, you know, one of the posts you said is someone famous living here. I hadn't actually thought about the volume of response that people might get. Was 3,000 the most, do you think? That one at the boarding school, do you think that was?
That was two lads together, wasn't it?
That was two lads together. But most of them got more than 1,000.
Yeah.
And if you think there was a new set every week,
you know, that's incredible, isn't it?
Later, and there would be 24 new teenagers looking for pen pals. But of course, the thing was, although it was so exciting for them all on day one, as most of them said, it was too many to deal with. So you started just going through them, going, "Oh, that one didn't write anything interesting. Just that goes in the bin." Because people did want to find people to correspond with. But, I mean, where do you start with 1,000 people?
I know one of our ladies, she was a little bit older, and a lot of the people who wrote to her were a lot younger. And so she ended up giving out the letters to her, I think it was some younger friends and some people at school, so that other people could have international pen pals, which is really lovely.
That's really sweet.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, we were very excited about this quest. It literally consumed every waking, breathing second of our life for, you know, almost a year.
And it's such a fun quest. I mean, I've not read every single word. I've dipped in and out and I've loved it. And I just think it's absolutely wonderful. And I keep going back to pages and going, "Oh my God, that's so lovely." And I have to read out this one. I mean, this is so perfectly 80s. "Okay, all you sexy, dark-haired, dark-eyed, hunky guys." I mean, that's just thrilling to me. "If you're a Michael Praed or lead singer from A-ha lookalike." I love the fact they didn't actually know the lead singer from A-ha's name. "Any old punk aged between 13 and 18, and you like most music from The Cure to Arcadia, but cannot stand Wham. yeah. and are a bit stupid, as in a bit mad and zany. Put pen to paper and write too. I mean, it's just fantastic. It's so of its time. I can't imagine it being in any other era, that kind of, you know, calling someone a sexy hunk. It's just so sweet, isn't it, compared to the whole idea of people on Instagram posting inappropriate pictures. And, you know, it's just how refreshingly different. Did it take you back and make you think about how much society has changed?
I think communication has changed enormously. I mean, Sarah said before we started, we met online.
Best £65 I ever spent.
I mean,
Guardian soulmates no longer exists.
That was old school internet dating, in that you there was no swiping left and right. It was you had to commit to writing to each other. So we essentially got to know each other by exchanging hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of words.
Thousands. Yeah. See, I sense a new book here. I mean, you know, surely, as you say, Guardian soulmates no longer exist. And I think that's what you should do. You should do, instead of RSV people, you should do Guardian people or soulmates people. Or there we are, you know. Yeah. Find out all those people who met, because Guardian soulmates, which was such a big thing not even that long ago, suddenly seems archaic.
That's a really good idea, Lucinda.
We heard it here first, everyone. Yeah. When it comes out.
But I do know several people who've got married through Guardian soulmates, and we are as well. But you're right, it's that the slowness of the letter and the taking the time. So we, very soppy, but we had already fallen in love before we actually physically met. And we were sort of, you know, we'd exchanged so much information. We'd spoken on the phone, and we're like, we have to meet, and if we don't have chemistry, this is my friend for life. And thankfully we did have chemistry. And we're getting
so you really got that. I mean, you've been there. So when you were contacting these pen pals, this was a real kind of labor of love as well, wasn't it? Because you can see this in the book as well, how as you said, it's about your relationship as well. And you're contacting these people for whom writing letters was, of course, such a major thing. And you can appreciate how that relationship grows. I just think it takes us back to a time where, do you think we'll ever get back to that? Do you think there'll come a time when people want to write again? Do you think, I mean, I remember in lockdown, they said sales of writing paper had soared. Whether that's stuck or not, I don't know.
I think it's interesting. There's a thing called the slow food movement as well. And I think that we're so fast and we're so distracted and, you know, constant dopamine hits, and that sense of overwhelm, which I think for a lot of people during lockdown kind of recalibrated. And I definitely sense amongst people of our generation that there is a desire for some stillness and calmness, which doesn't mean, you know, atrophy, you know, we're still busy, still moving around and doing things, but I think it's about trying to be in the moment and actually appreciate it. And there's something about the investment of time. I mean, we both write, and we both write using computers, but if I'm making a show, I spend a lot of time with chunky pens and post-it notes, and there's something about the hands-on manual nature. So I do think there's, maybe it's not a return to, but a blending back in with that presence of in-person, you know, in-person. And it's also just getting older. I think I'm valuing real-time contact with my friends more than I am, you know, what do they always say? Facebook is where you lie to your friends, and Twitter is where you tell the truth to strangers.
I think that's worryingly true. So I'd like to hear from all you Goldster people here. Do you remember Smash Hits? And did you ever have a pen pal? So please do put it in the chat if you had a pen pal, and if you've got a lovely pen pal story. And also, do you still hand write letters? And if so, how frequently? Because I would really love to know that. Every new year I have a resolution, I'm going to hand write more letters. Well, it's now Easter and I've not really done any this year. I've done a lot of postcards, but not letters. And it's just finding the time quite often. It's so much easier to sit down and send an email. But I've just been going through my parents' loft, and I have found boxes upon boxes of letters that I received when I was at school and when I was at university. And it just is such a glorious thing to have. I don't sit and go through my old emails, but I will sit and read through all of these. So do you have things like that as well? Are you hoarders of that kind of thing? Did you keep all your letters? So Sarah is pointing. So Paul Cronell, fess up. Are you a hoarder?
I am.
Collector.
I'm a collector, but I'm a hoarder of nostalgia.
Yeah.
I have this, I think I mention it in the book, that I think it's, if there's a single, I mean, I used to keep the ticket stub, you know, the bus ticket, you know, going when I was a teenager, used to keep all that. But these days, a single item can open up a whole chapter of memory. And I find it, it's the sort of thing, you've got boxes that are filled with what essentially is just personal tat.
Yeah.
If the box disappeared, you probably wouldn't care. But whenever you open up that box and you go, you know, there's that letter from my mum. And yeah, suddenly you're reminded of that moment. And if the memory was gone forever, you wouldn't miss it because you can't miss what you can't remember. But the fact that you've got these keys to the past, I find means an awful lot to me. And Sarah just knows that if she marries, when she marries me, she marries the boxes as well.
You're definitely similar in that sort of emotional hoarding. But I think what you do stuff with it. So Paul does a lovely thing. He makes an annual review, which is all the photos from the year put into a lovely book so that we can look back. And because they exist in a beautiful hard, I mean, it takes you months to do it. It's beautiful. And it means that we have a physical record of each year that we've been together. It's really, really lovely. But I do think, because we've moved house so many times, I think, I mean, I've still got a letter that my best friend wrote me on an entire roll of kitchen roll. Because he ran out of paper and I've still got the kitchen roll and nothing. I know I'll be buried wrapped in it. You know, I can't. But I think it's important to open the box sometimes and to look at it. And then, as you know, we were talking before about bereavement and grief. Sometimes there's a time where you're ready to let go of something. And I think if you're not, it's really important to hold on to it while it's still serving you. But I think over time, I've got rid of everything to do with ex-boyfriends and partners, because obviously I've met the perfect man. but you think, well, am I keeping this to torture myself? Or am I keeping this because it's nourishing? And I think if it's nourishing you and it's giving you something, then, you know.
I was going through boxes of letters yesterday with my university flatmates. And this is from the 1990s. And I saw one. It was from one of the girls who was there. I handed it to her and she started laughing. And she'd written in it, you know, thank goodness I can get rid of this really ugly card. I think I was starting a new job or whatever. And then she said, listen to this bit. And she'd written, P.S. the reason I'm sending this to you is that I know you keep all this stuff forever and you're going to have this ugly card forever. And there it was, reading it from the 1990s. And she said, wow. You're absolutely right. I knew you that well. And it was just the perfect moment. Well, I can't get rid of that now.
That needs to be great.
Created this new moment.
Yeah.
And, so we've got a comment here. I live in South Africa, but was at boarding school and letters were so important. I miss writing letters. I had a pen pal in the UK, but after school, we didn't stay in touch. Well, you know, I think you need to find another one, Debbie. I think you need to get yourself a pen pal today. I don't know how you do it today. Smash Hits doesn't exist anymore, but there must be a way. It is true. I think I miss writing letters and most of all, I miss receiving real proper letters. And of course, if you don't write them, you don't receive them, as my mother always used to tell me. So
a Goldster pen pal club.
That's what I was thinking, Sarah Lou. I was thinking we need a Goldster pen pal thing. So I'm going to put that out there to Joe, our lovely concierge today, and see if we can get Goldster pen pals going. And welcome from South Africa. It's lovely to have a message from you. Did anybody else here have pen pals? I had pen pals. We moved house when I was 10. And my oldest friend I've known since I was 4, first day of primary school, we met. And we're still very good friends. And we wrote letters to each other constantly. For a couple of years, we stopped. Neither of us can remember who started writing again. But we have all those letters. One day I will find them all in a box somewhere. And they'll be hilarious. But it just records decades of friendship. It's so important.
It's like you say, it's very interesting. An email letter just doesn't hold the same emotional value, does it?
No.
So it literally isn't just the words. It is the tangible, you know, piece of paper in your hand. When we were writing the book, my youngest son was 9 or 10 at the time, and he had never heard of a pen pal. And so I found him a pen pal website, which is sort of friends around the world. And it's, you know, of course, it's all very protective about age and parental guidance and all that. But the pen pals, the pen letters they were writing were sort of like 20 or 30 words. And that's it.
Yes.
And they just disappeared. There was no value to them at all. It's, you know, on one level, it was kind of, you know, when we were growing up, if you were going to write a letter to South Africa, you know, South Africa, that's a billion miles away. How exciting. And now you can turn on your computer and you can find someone from South Africa just by searching people who live in South Africa, you know. And so the magic of distance has disappeared for certainly young people.
I think it's that thing of delayed gratification. And we all know, you know, you used to send off your photos to get developed and a month later, one good photo would return, all the others would be blurry. And also, you know, you'd send a letter. And I remember going, I mean, I was an avid pen pal writer, and I had friends all around the world, and just going to the stamp counter and getting the stamp and being excited to see what was on that. And funny enough, I received a letter a few days ago from my old Polish pen pal, and we had written from the age of 17 to about 30, and then we lost touch, and she found me on social media and she asked for my address, and then she just sent me a handwritten, you know, we're grown up, she's a doctor, she's got three kids, but she said there was something about taking the time and space to write the letter that was really precious. And I thought, well, I must return that and you know, rather than just do a massive download of everything that's happened, because something happens, I think, in the time that it takes to write by hand, your thought process slows down. Although I used to write, now I don't think I can write as much. I used to have a little stubby patch on my finger
My biggest problem is that whenever I write anything now, nobody can read it. And I look at my teenage letters, and my handwriting was actually quite good then. I mean, I write, when I give my students back their exam papers, I will inevitably get them saying, what does this say? And I just, my handwriting has become appalling. And that is through spending all my life, like Paul, writing on a computer. And my handwriting is embarrassing now.
Do you find that from writing on a computer? I also, because of course you write whatever you want and then you edit it and the computer spell checks it and you can do all that. It drives me mad now when I do write by hand. As soon as I've made a mistake, I have this tussle inside me that I should start again. Because, you know.
No, suddenly, I just cross it out. Definitely.
Oh, do you? I admire your bravery.
We originally planned to write all of the initial 20 letters by hand and then Paul did a quick working out of how long it would take us. And I think it was going to take us several days. I mean, do you know what? It's fine. We'll sign them by hand.
Yeah.
but I think, Paul, what you really need, you see, it's the nostalgia thing. You are yearning for Tippex. That is what I think the problem is.
Yeah.
Anybody here remembers Tippex, that little white paint you used to put over and you could, you could go over your mistakes. And I remember looking on the back of the, to see if I could see what it said underneath the Tippex.
Well, I still have a paper diary and I will not be moved on this. I have a paper diary, as anyone who's read the book will know, I have a four-color biro, red for times, black for information, green for fun stuff, who uses blue? but I find the act of writing the thing in my diary, the appointment, means that then I remember it. But I'm very reassured by my physical diary, and people send me electronic invitations to things and I'm like, what am I going to do with that?
As soon as you accept the electronic invitation, it goes into your junk mail, which I then spend my whole time going, can you just email it to me again? Because I don't have it. Now, we have another comment here. My friend who lives in Italy used to write letters to me for years. For me, writing letters was a chore, but as soon as the internet was within my capabilities, I became a regular correspondent with her. Now we contact each other daily because she has caught up with a smiley face. Absolutely true. I mean, that really is the case, Denise. I know that it's so much easier to. I actually had a text from my old French pen friend the other day. She was coming over to England and sadly I was not around. So the other day, it was probably last year. But it was really nice to have heard from somebody who, you know, must have got in touch at some point and swapped contact details. But yes, it was a lot easier to get a WhatsApp and say, I'm really sorry I'm not around then, but let's meet up next time, rather than waiting for the letter to arrive. But
yes,
it would have been fun, like your pen pal did.
Now, I was going to say, I think there's something that, I think there are only a certain number of people you can really hold close in your heart and have absolutely daily regular contact with. And for that, we spend so much time apart because I'm on the road a lot and we do a lot of WhatsApp voice messages. And to me, that's lovely. And we have a thing in the morning when we're together that Paul will read poems. We're working our way through several poetry anthologies. So while I've been away for the last few weeks, I wake up and in my WhatsApp, I've got recordings of a couple of poems. So that's beautiful. If I had to wait for him to handwrite them, I'm in my back home.
We've got a comment here. Funny you should mention Tippex. We were telling our niece's 10-year-old daughter about Tippex and she was absolutely incredulous. It was such a thing. I mean, if it went dry and you couldn't use it, I don't know if everyone remembers that, when you went to use it and that little brush had gone dry and you're just shaking the bottle with that little, whatever it was, a ball bearing in it or something to try and make it liquid again, putting a bit of Tippex thinner in it to try and eke it out. It was so important.
Decorate your school bag as well. I seem to remember doing a lot of painting things with Tippex.
And I guess it probably doesn't even exist now. It's probably highly toxic.
I own several colours of it.
Oh, it does exist, does it? Yeah. I can't
believe it exists. My diary, if I make a mistake.
That's hilarious. You see, you can be together for a long time and still learn
about who you
never knew about.
6 years, we've had the tipping conversation.
So tell us, you mentioned performing, Sarah Lou. Tell us about what you do, because it's very exciting. As you say, you're constantly dashing around at the moment.
I feel very lucky. I make a lot of my own work. I had a very conventional start to my performing life. I read English and drama at Bristol University as academic subjects, and then I trained in musical theatre at Mountview, which back then we used to call Lay Mountview, because so many people from Mountview ended up in Lay Mis. But back then, and it's much better now, but back then it was all about having a particular sound, and everybody had to sound the same. So if you went to see Lay Mis in London, it needed to sound the same as Lay Mis in New York. And I never really fitted in. I didn't sound like all of the other singers. And so I ended up making my own work. And over the past, I would say 15 years, I think most of my time as a performer has been making my own work. And I'm currently on tour with a show called An Evening Without Kate Bush, which is, it's not a tribute act, but it's kind of like a clown does a gig. Would that be fair?
Yeah. I don't know how you answered that without getting into trouble right away, actually.
It's a very joyful celebration of wonderful. Kate Bush's music, but the focus, the lens is the fans, because she had this 35-year gap when she wasn't performing live. So again, it's about community. And I think that for both of us, we really love work that taps into community. And for that show particularly, about what it's like to be in the room together. So over lockdown, I did quite a lot of online gigs, but that was a show I thought, no, that's about being together in the same room and sharing that experience of enjoying something in real time, actually. So there is that similarity of like slowing down time. But I'm off to Brussels next weekend to go and do a new musical in Brussels for a few months, and then I'll be in Australia. But I've got about three or four shows in rotation. So sometimes I'm doing the Kate Bush show, sometimes I'm doing I've got a show called The Silent Treatment, which is about voice loss. But it's and I think the RSV people would make a really great two-hander play that we should do in Edinburgh.
I think that's a great idea. Absolutely. Yeah. I think the Edinburgh Festival next year, that's what we want to see. So Paul, tell us about you, because you're a writer. Tell us about your career and how you got to this point.
Well, as Sarah was, I spent my 20s working as an actor. I trained as an actor. I did an acting course at university, and I did that the whole of my 20s. And then I moved to London, and I went from I'd been living in Wales, where I felt like I was an enormous fish in a tiny, tiny, tiny pond. I moved to London, and it was like being a goldfish in the Atlantic Ocean. And I lost interest very quickly. A friend of mine had always wanted to write comedy sketches. So he and I had been writing a few sketches. We wrote for Spitting Image and Russ Abbott and Hale and Pace and Brian Conley. We like to think that we killed off all their careers. Not quite single-handedly, but when they were all prime time, we were freelancing comedy stuff. And then my friend went and got a proper job, and I decided that I wanted to start writing film scripts. And I was extremely lucky that the second script I wrote got picked up and was made as a lowish budget movie, but it was a film called Four. It was a gritty, dark thriller.
Sean Pertwee and
Martin Compston, and it's actually on Netflix at the moment, strangely. Oh, it disappeared for years, and then it arrived on Netflix. And then through that, I got another couple of films made. And but the film industry was still is a very, because it's a collaborative art, which means that everyone wants to change every single thing that you've written. So when I had the opportunity, so I still write screenplays. I've just, the latest one has just gone out to my agent. But as soon as I'd never written a book. Oh, I had written one book.
Picking Up Pants.
I wrote a book called Picking Up Pants.
You better tell us what Picking Up Pants is about.
Well, I spent 20 years working backstage in the West End. So I worked backstage on Les Mis and Aladdin, but I worked as a dresser. And most of the dressers were seamstresses, yeah. People, you know, who could make. And I was a writer stroke actor who essentially all I did was pick up pants, you know, because you just set costumes, you collected costumes and what have you. And I wrote a sort of, it was never published, but it was the first long prose that I wrote. And it was about a dresser in the West End about to have the worst week of his life. But I had enjoyed that so much because of the control I had over the words. So with the RSV people, the fact that every day I'd spend half the day searching for the pen pals and the other half of the day writing up what had happened and what was going on. So I found that I'm now writing, I'm writing more prose. I'm halfway through a psychological crime novel.
Brilliant.
But I've written so many things. I you know, started off doing TV sketch comedy. I wrote for Mother and Baby magazine for a while. I've written for the stage. You know, I'm a storyteller. I like stories more than anything else. And the RSV people, that was a story in the same way that the films were a story. Writing for Brian Connolly was tiny little stories. And so, you know, Sarah gets to travel the world and I get to go upstairs to the spare room and sit at my desk and tap these stories out.
Sorry, Sarah.
No, go on. I was going to say, I was talking about the process of writing the book.
Just what I was about to ask. Yeah. Exactly that synchronicity there. Tell us about what it was like when you were writing the book. What was your process?
Well, because I'm very kindly credited as essential contributions. I would say we worked together on the production coordination, like all of the nuts and bolts and things. But at a certain point in any writing partnership, someone has to do the writing. Mm. And I would say I'm a theatre maker and a storyteller. I think you're a proper, proper writer. So Paul would graft away on the script, on the book. And it was lovely. Every evening, open a bottle of wine and he'd read to me every day. So I'd get to hear back 24 hours after something had happened what the story was. And we had a busy WhatsApp where we'd, like, if we suddenly thought of things to include or quotes or stories or pictures. And then I would say probably one of the toughest things we've done together is editing.
Yeah.
Because actually Paul writes a really good first draft, but my mum was an English teacher. So I am a stickler for grammar and things. So we'd sit side by side going through the notes on this. And it was a very joyless process, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a necessary process,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, but I'm proud to say I don't think there's a single typo in our book. And I've read a lot of books published by some major houses that have got typos in them.
That's very true.
I've read not 100%, but I've read probably about three quarters of this book, and I haven't spotted one yet. And I am a stickler, so like Sarah Lou, I you know, started out as a book editor, and I get frustrated by typos in books. And so I think you've done a very, very good job. And I love that process of working together. I have done that before. And it's actually really powerful as a writer. I know we've got a lot of aspiring writers on Goldster. And I would say that actually that's something that is seldom talked about, the importance of collaboration. And if you have a person you can really trust, reading your work back, it's what I always tell students when they're writing essays as well, that before you hand it in, read it aloud to yourself, read it into Absolutely. A voice recorder. And listen to the cadence of the words. Did you find, Paul, that when you were reading it aloud, you discovered a lot of things, or was Sarah Lou picking up on the things that you needed to change?
Well, strangely, the whole book really is a 400-page monologue. So because my experience was in writing film scripts, they are essentially the most pared-down dialogue that you can possibly have. So I'm very used to writing out loud, as it were. So I would write whatever was in my head, and then my very first edit on a page would be me speaking it out loud just to myself. And as soon as you find yourself and you can't get the words out, you know that somebody's brain could follow that in an easier way. So a lot of the time, by the time I came to read it to Sarah, I hopefully had made it work for my speaking.
Yes.
But yes, immediately you'll notice. The thing you always notice when you read it out loud is repeated words and phrases.
And that's I'd be going, so brilliant, but you'd just repeated that word, or we've said that already in this bit. It's funny. So, well, you can talk more about the music soundtrack, but Paul also wrote a play during lockdown. And the two lead characters in this play had very strong Irish accents. And so I would kind of creep into the room to see if he wanted a coffee. And all I could hear was this sort of you talking out loud to yourself in two voices. And I think, okay, I'm going to leave him because he's in that the music of the delivery.
Yeah.
And that was actually really lovely. It was called Millstones, and it got picked up to be toured for six weeks with Maloney in the lead. But then we had the second phase of lockdown. So unfortunately that didn't happen.
I hope it happens one day.
Yeah, we did a reading in London with Marcus Brigstocke and Michael Maloney, and they're both very keen to do it. So hopefully that will. But I think you're the first person I know that creates a soundtrack. And I know you've been listening to lots of podcasts about writers. So other, I don't know if any of your people do that as well, but would you want to talk a bit about that? Because I think that's fascinating.
The first thing I do whenever I start any new project is I spend sometimes half a day going through an extensive music collection picking out songs, not songs that would fit the finished film, TV series, but ones that evoke the feel of the project. And the reason I do that is that I then write listening to the same songs. So the RSV people was about 40 songs.
I really want to know what they were. I was just about to say, what was the soundtrack for RSV people?
It was a very varied one, but everything had to have a sort of upbeat, fun feel to it. Because then sometimes, especially if you've got to work on more than one project at once, the soundtrack can work like a Pavlov's dogs kind of thing. So the psychological thriller that I'm writing at the moment, very dark, very sort of gloomy music. So I put on headphones to write that. And if I had to rewrite the RSV people, I'd immediately just go back to that soundtrack.
Great idea.
But the thing is, with the RSV people, I can barely listen to the songs now because I've listened to each one of them about 500 times. And so I'm back in the... We were very lucky when I wrote the book. We'd had a funny thing, but we were renting a flat. The landlord, his daughter needed somewhere to live. And when our contract was up, we suddenly found ourselves in the middle of lockdown, sort of homeless for about 3/4 of an hour. And a friend of ours who owns a huge big house in Clapham said, come and live with me. So we were very lucky. We got to live in this beautiful big house in Clapham.
With a heated floor.
Wow. Maybe left.
She had an office at the end of the garden. So my working day was have breakfast, have coffee, have second coffee, walk down the garden to the office. And now if I hear any music from the writing soundtrack of the RSV people, I'm back in that office.
Yes.
I'm back, you know, and it never changes. And I think those songs are now ruined for anything other than that book.
It's amazing how music can take you back. I mean, I'm not a musician at all, unlike Sarah Lou, but music can just take you back to such a place in time. I was wondering, actually, if you were going to have written, maybe you did, if you were going to write in Smash Hits asking for pen pals, who would have been your musical choice? Because it's so funny how they're identified. People don't put much about their interests, I guess, because it was Smash Hits other than the music. Mm. And they're very... Who do you think yours would have been at that time?
And a lot of people don't like Wham, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I think that was unfair. Yeah.
We have quite a lot of crossover. We would definitely have had the Smiths in common.
Yes.
I would have had The Cure and Kate Bush. What do you have from that era?
Well, it depends what age I was. I mean, I was a massive Adam and the Ants fan.
Adam Ant would have been mine.
Oh,
Adam Ant and Skritti Pallitti. Does anyone else ever remember Skritti Pallitti? I love
him. Yeah. I think there was so much music. You were, I was one of those people who liked to go down to, am I going to be able to remember? I think they were called Buzz Records in Chorlton. And I used to walk there and I used to love going through the singles by hand.
I mean, I go to HMV all the time and go through all the singles and the Smiths as well. I met up with a friend in my late 30s and we hadn't seen each other, we're childhood friends. He bumped into my parents and asked for my number. We hadn't seen each other since I was 14 and he was 16. And he told me that the last conversation he ever remembers having was a very earnest one about the Smiths. And that was his overriding memory of me. And I said, well, yes, you know, I can remember that conversation. It's such things that are etched on your memory.
Quoting the lyrics of the Queen Is Dead album was definitely something in our early courtship. I thought, if this guy knows the lyrics to Suede Head, I'm in. I should point out that trying to pick a first dance is being really hard because so many of my favourite songs have been used as soundtracks for your...
I just want to now make a comment about the picture. For those of you who can see this, for those of you on the podcast who can't, you've got to get hold of this book and you've got to see it because I think this is what you should look like at your wedding. So can you please describe to those of you who are listening rather than watching, and what was this photo shoot like? It looks so much fun.
It was so much fun. I actually, the person who did the makeup does makeup for drag queens, which I think you can tell.
Well, so tell us about this. Sarah, your outfit and Paul, your outfit. Tell us about how you got hold of these and how you came up with those.
None of the stuff was our own, was it?
A couple of little bits and pieces, but our lovely, our friend Tom Shaw, who did our makeup for us, he just said, bring some stuff. And we turned up on the day and he had bits of wig and bits of material. And I think we raided a couple of things from Sophie's, our friend who we were staying with. But we definitely, we had some looks and we had some ideas and we had the kind of New Romantics look, or we had the more kind of punky vibe. But obviously we were trying to make ourselves look like we were a cover of Smash Hits magazine. And a very good friend, Angus, who did the picture, a very good friend of mine, passed away very sadly a couple of years before. And I'd met this wonderful man, Angus, because he was a mutual friend and we'd supported her through end of life care. And so, and he turned out to be a photographer. So it was a really wonderful kind of team effort of people helping out. But we'd never done I've done lots of photo shoots because of my job, but we'd never done one together. You looked, I mean, I just can't get over how you
Paul, looked. The frilly shirt with the leather jacket, Paul. I mean, I think that's a look that really needs to come back. I mean, your makeup is so Duran Duran, isn't it? It's fabulous. I'm sure Simon Le Bon wore exactly that blusher in his career. And Sarah Lou, I mean, you've got the big earrings, the hair scarf, the Bananarama hairstyle, and then this very kind of sexy off-the-shoulder leather jacket.
I think it's only off the shoulder because it didn't fit me. I think there's a lot. What are you? If there's a reverse picture of this, there'd be gaffer tape kind of holding on half a wig and half an earring. But yeah, I love it.
And our bottom halves were just whatever we turned up in, weren't they?
Yeah.
Oh, so it's like doing Zoom.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right, yeah. Exactly.
I promise everybody, but I am actually fully clothed, just so that in case of inquiries, I'm literally sitting on Zoom, not fully clothed. And we've got a comment here that you look a bit like Alistair McGowan. Of course, he was so good at doing.
I look like Alistair McGowan.
I think that was aimed at Paul Serrilly, but I'm not entirely sure.
Alistair McGowan, yes. Yeah. Oh, well, right.
So, anyway, we're getting lots of laughs in the chat from this, so I do like this. So, joking apart here, what's the most poignant thing you found out about this book? Because it's people's lives as well. I mean, we're looking at, you know, people who were then in their teens who are now in their 50s. What was the bit that really, was there a moment that really made you go, oh, apart, we've mentioned, of course, that the chap who'd gone to prison, but was there a moment that made you really stop and think, wow, that's a, you know, this is a kind of life lesson?
Well, I tell you what, there was, I keep thinking about how much to give away. No, there was.
Please give away.
There was one individual we couldn't find. We in one way or another, we didn't get to communicate with everybody, but I found everybody, bar one person, and most people were in their late 40s to, I think, the oldest probably in her late 50s, but I have a feeling that the one person I couldn't find may have died. And that was what started out as, you know, we're reading about all these teenagers and Adam and the Ants and Wham and Hair and fledgling romance. And that one of that cohort is potentially no longer with us. And that was another reminder that life and communication and love and making an effort to be there for the people who matter to you needs to be done soon, if not now, immediately, because most of the people we found were happy in their lives, whatever their different lives were, but this one person's life took a different route. And I think that once, I don't know that necessarily occurred to me while we were writing it, because I didn't give up on trying to find them, even once the book was published. But I have now run out of avenues, and it's the only thing I can think of. It may not be true. I truly hope that that person is out there. They changed their name. They're now living a wonderful life in the south of France or something. But that life is short.
Yeah.
Even though
that's a really good lesson to take away from it as well. And as you say, make those connections, you know, get in touch with the people who matter to you now, because, you know, you really don't know what's going to happen. Well, let's talk about the response to the book. Have you had people who've contacted you since it came out who remember writing themselves to Smash Hits, or have you had any kind of connections like that?
Well, I feel like I'm keeping my voice.
No, yeah, we've definitely had some people. We had one person who read the book and then got in touch with you to sort of to say they wanted you to try and work out who they were, because they thought you might like the challenge of trying to work out another person. And we were like,
oh, there was someone else who definitely was in the same edition of Smash Hits.
No, it was someone who'd read the book.
And I see.
Enjoyed the sort of, the kind of treasure hunt detective work. And so they sent a letter.
Clues.
Yeah, with clues as to who they were. And we thought, this is terribly sweet, but also we're quite busy. I think what's been really lovely, again, without too many spoilers, is how many of the people we've contacted, and we obviously told them, you know, we didn't know we were writing a book right from the start. We were doing a project. Mm. And, you yes. know, we've obviously shared that we've written the book with everybody who's part of it and given them thanks. And a lot of them have read the book, and we have met up with some of them and
how some lovely. Of
them become our friends.
That's great.
Really, really special. And I think that was a completely unexpected, beautiful thing that came from it. Now, we've self-published, and I don't know if any of the people that are with Goldster are in that situation. You know, it's very, very hard to get someone to look at a new book. You have to have an agent before you can have a publisher. And we did send out a lot of messages. Mm. And we were also mindful that in a lot of agents, it might be that the first person who's reading your email might be 20, 21, they might be younger. They
no
might,
idea what smash hits were.
Might not connect yeah. with the... And in the end, we decided to self-publish, which was huge. I mean, I think we sweated blood, especially you, over trying to just format the book to print it. But actually, it was an immensely empowering thing. And I think that's, like you talked about, you know, you can see the world as full of all these gatekeepers and these guardians. And actually, the people who've read the book, you know, we've not sold millions of copies, but we've sold copies to people who we know and then to people who we don't know. And the response to that, the things that people have said, we've had messages from people who've, it's made them reconnect with their old pen pals.
How it's lovely. Made them
grab life and go, yeah. hold on a minute, I need to be in touch with that person. And it's been, it's hugely humbling and very beautiful to think that something that we've worked on is now sitting in someone's hands and has made a difference to their life. And occasionally I had a guy come up, I was doing my show in Bristol, and this guy came up for an autograph afterwards, and he had the book and he went, oh, will you sign it? And I was like,
oh, lovely. That's brilliant. Well, and I think self-publishing has changed massively. I know lots of traditionally published authors who are choosing to self-publish because you actually, you very seldom make, you know, sell thousands of copies, hundreds of thousands of copies and make a huge amount of royalties anyway, however you publish. It's all in the, you know, the journey of it and the things that you do around books that most authors will say will really make them the money. I mean, J.K. Rowling, for example, she will have made far more money from her books being turned into films than she'll ever have made from the books themselves. So, but I think it's just such a great journey to have done as a self-published book. And I wouldn't have known from looking at it that it was self-published. So that used to be that big change between what was traditionally published and what was self-published. But I think now traditional publishers use exactly the same route as self-publishers do. So I think
friends of mine who've had publishers, you still end up needing to do just as much PR, just as much, you know, with a very much, you know, you know, who are your networks? How are you going to help us sell this book? So
absolutely. I mean, that was my biggest shock, having been, you know, been published, is that how appalling most publishers' publicity and PR departments are. They promise a huge amount, but you do end up doing it all yourself. And that's advice I always give to aspiring authors, is don't think you're going to get a publicist who's going to do more than a couple of weeks. And, you know, it's all up to you. And you need to constantly tell your publisher that something's happening, that you're doing an event, they need to get books there or whatever. It's really, you know, a huge part of what you are doing is exactly what every traditionally published author ends up doing as well.
Yeah.
I was quite shocked to read that you can pay for a position on a bookshelf. We were looking at the top 10, how that works.
Yes.
I shouldn't have been surprised, really, but I thought, gosh, that's no wonder that we keep seeing those same books. That's number one, number two, number three. And again, you know, I'd rather have a connection with a smaller number of people who really care and are reading the book than sort of, it's like paying for social media followers. It seems such a strange thing.
Yeah.
And Stuart Lee, the stand-up comedian, has written some wonderful books. And he talked about realizing early on that if he had 10,000 fans and they came to see him perform twice a year, he could afford to live. And I think someone like Amanda Palmer, who wrote The Art of Asking, that a connection with an audience who actually want to see your work. And, you know, I'm not famous, but I make a living from my work because I fostered a relationship with an audience who want to come and see my work. And I think it's very empowering. And I think it's the way forward, definitely.
Yeah. Yes, I think it is really fascinating. I remember first discovering that those books on the tables in places like Waterstones and Daunts and Hatchards and things, that yes, the publishers pay to have those books on the table. And it looks as if it's the choice of the people who work in the bookshop, and it absolutely isn't. And unless your publisher is willing to pay, your book is not going to be there.
I heard an interesting, I was listening to a podcast a couple of days ago, and there was an author on there, and she didn't have a traditional publisher at all. She had chosen to go with a, she didn't self-publish, but she went with a digital publisher. And she made the point that she thinks that over time, digital copies of books will overtake the paperbacks, if only because the paperbacks now are having to get more and more expensive because they don't sell as many in order for people to make their money. And also from an eco point of view, you know, an ebook cuts down no trees. But also that with Amazon, which is now, on the one hand, almost sadly, it's the number one place anyone buys a book on anything. Mm. So although Waterstones still has its beautifully curated tables and what have you, most of us are just going to, I mean, a lot of the time, go into Waterstones and then see if it's cheaper on Amazon. That, unfortunately, is how people are buying their books now. So I think you were quite right going back to what you said, the self-publishing route, the digital publishing route, they have a lot more respect than they used to, because it used to all be seen as, you know, vanity publishing. Mm, yeah. But and like you say, we're very pleased that you can't tell that the RSV people is not a traditionally published book.
Well, I'm going to tell everybody they need to get a copy of this. I've put a couple of links in the chat, but if those of you listening on the podcast, just Google RSV people. Oh, other search engines are available, by the way. And if you're wondering how that's spelled, it's like RSVP, like a letter, and then EPLE at the end.
Yes.
Comes people. Written by Paul Cronell and Sarah Louise Young, who have been most gorgeous guests. Thank you so much. I do hope you'll write something else and come back on again. And for those of you who want to see Sarah Lou's show, I've put a link to the RSV people website in there, and you can find her work through there. And you also have in the chat Instagram and Twitter and things handles. Do you want to say, for the benefit of the podcast, what your social media handles are?
Yes, I'm on Twitter and Instagram. I'm Sly Theatre Maker, S-L-Y Theatre Maker. Partly is because I share the name with a porn star. So if you're Googling me, please put the hyphen in. And we have the RSV people on Instagram and on Twitter and on Facebook. And you are?
Twitter and I fall out of friendship. I'm at Paulie Crom.
On Instagram?
I think I'm and Twitter. I think I'm both those, yeah.
Thank you so much. And yes, Sarah Louise was telling me beforehand that she does actually, when she gets post that is meant for the porn star, she actually very kindly redirects that email to the correct person, which I think is extremely nice. I worry about some of the responses you're going to get, but I think that's
another show. That's another book.
if you ever get an email, obviously from Donald Trump, you could make yourself a fortune. So just to let you know, and I'm getting a bit topical there. I'm just going to tell everybody very quickly what is coming up on Goldster. And that is to say that have a lovely Easter, everybody. On Tuesday, I am back on the show PPG, our sister show, and I'll be talking to Zan Tyler, who is a singer songwriter. She's talking about her debut album coming out next year, which is all about female empowerment. She is going to talk about what it's like being a woman in the music industry, and she's been in the music industry since she was in her late teens, and what it really is like out there. And then next week, I'm going to be interviewing this fabulous writer, Alexis Keir. This is his first book. It is a beautiful memoir, Windward Family, and it's gorgeous. It's about living between, well, growing up in a family that came from St. Vincent in the Caribbean and growing up between the two communities. Really talented writer. He works full time and he's written this gorgeous memoir. So do join me next Friday for that. And Humphrey will be back with you on Thursday next week. And he is talking to Monique Roffey, and she is the author of a really great book, The Mermaid of Black Conch, which is a fascinating new novel. So I think it's a mythical love story between a fisherman and a mermaid. And of course, for those of you who are reading for our Book of the Month this month, you've got Humphrey this month, and it's Franz Kafka, Metamorphosis. So as you know, you all voted which one you wanted, and that one won out. So take care, everybody. Have a lovely weekend. I will look forward to seeing you on Tuesday. Paul, Sarah Lou, it's been an absolute joy to meet you. And Sarah, good luck with all your travels.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.